Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahana Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvi Navaditamastu Mahavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. For the imaginary Buddhi, please would you take us through how to do this? That is, how to set it up, i.e. what could it contain, what could it Well, you're talking about, I think, the what we did today, juxtaposing the buddhi that has a imaginary scene that you imagine, you know, juxtaposed against a buddhi that is using sense organs to provide the content. You know, any buddhi, there's the aham, the consciousness, is there reflecting in the buddhi. And then there's also the namarupa. The namarupa, the name form, that's what we call the content. And so how to set up that, just as a little exercise that I was talking about in the class, was if you just let yourself have an imagination, it could be a still life or it could be a moving imagination, it doesn't really matter. The point is that when you're having an imagination, you know it's an imagination, and so there is no ahankara attached to it, right? You don't take yourself to be that. And so since there's the absence of the ahankara, there's just nothing in terms of your preset notions, I mean the kind of the beginningless notions, that causes you to that constricts you from being able to see that your being is the self of the whole imagination. Because there's nothing in the imagination has a sense of reality for you. It's an imagination, right? And so you become like the Ishwara of the imagination. If the imagination is Maya, it is Mithya, and you are itself. And that is kind of a paroksha, that's kind of a natural. You don't take yourself, yourself doesn't feel sequestered into your body. That stops you from being able to just recognize that the whole imagination, you know, rests in your being and consciousness. So that's something to play with, just using your buddhi to have imaginations where you recognize the relationship of you, the conscious being, to the imagination, and the fact that you don't have any more or less identity with any part of the imagination. Whereas, that frees you from that type of constriction, you can recognize yourself as the being which is the adhishtana of the entire imagination. There's nothing to stop you from recognizing that, or to make you be habitually contained in your body as a little pea in a pod. That doesn't happen in reference to an imagination. But when you are having a vritti with content that's brought about by sensory perception, just the fact that you're using your sense organs itself grounds you in this physical reality, which is not imaginal from your standpoint. If it was imaginal, you could make it come and go, right? But you can't do that. And so this is what we call Ishwara Srishti. It's the empirical reality which is not created by you, the jiva. So you don't have any sense of Ishwaratvam in terms of this from your own self-experience. So here in Ishwara, this body is not my imagination. And yet consciousness also pervades this body through the sense of touch and through my sense organs, my mind, etc. and the sense organs, my mind, etc. So this body, which is not imaginary, you know, enjoys consciousness. And these objects that I'm perceiving are also not imaginary. And so they have their own empirical reality. And so now when I use my sense organs to give me the content of the vritti, like right now if I'm looking out here, this little square, whatever it is in my field of, this is in my field of sight. So I'm having a vritti of this room with all of you in it. But I know this room is real. And I know this body, this room is not my imagination. This body is not my imagination. And so, and I have the sense of touch running through this body. And so when I sit and I have the sense of touch is predominant, sense of touch running through the body, the fact that this is all real in terms of whether it's my imagination or Bhagavan's imagination, it has its own reality. So now I sit with that vritti of what I'm experiencing, still just a vritti. My experience is still just a vritti. But it's very hard for me to get over the reality factor, right, in which this vritti is taking place. The vritti is about this world, you know. And so even though it's just a vritti, it's still very tied to this world, very tied to the body because of my notions, because of my preconceived notions. And so even though we have two vrittis, that's all, and those two vrittis are illumined by consciousness, both the vrittis are mithya, the whole world is mithya, that's another issue. Still, my relationship to that vritti is different. Even though both the vrittis are vrittis, they're exactly the same in terms of their reality, their quality. But it's not so easy for me to see that I am the self of the whole, imagination or of the whole vritti. When I'm using my sense organs and they're tied to this physical reality. But still, by practicing recognizing your relationship to the imaginal vritti, you could see, in fact, that the entire vritti enjoys your imagination and yourself and everything in it. You can recognize that fact. And then you can practice recognizing that fact in reference to a vritti filled with sense perceptions. Okay, so that's just a little exercise that can be useful. But another thing that Hal brought out, which this shows that there also, as part of this teaching, a need to recognize this empirical world that we call Ishvara's creation, the one that's not imagined by you, is to prove that it is mithya, that it has no meaning, no being of its own, that it has only dependent being. And to show that the common denominator of this real world, non-imaginal world from my perspective, you know, has the common denominator of being, it is, and of knownness. And then to recognize through the Driksha Viveka and different prakriyas that we use, to recognize beyond any doubt that this world is mithya, that it has no independent being. You have to do that, you know, because otherwise the world contains you, it is other than you, and it contains you. So that has to take place. And then as that becomes very more clear, the recognition that all of this has your being, in the aproksha, recognition of yourself not being apart from anything that you perceive. It's free of everything you perceive, but it's not apart from it. Sometimes I've used an example. It doesn't always work. If you just imagine, just put yourself, your being, in the middle of the room. Just in the middle of the room. Why say put yourself in the middle of the room if it actually is in the whole room? It's just to delocalize, you know, and see what that's like. Take this me, just focus on me. and then put that me in the middle of the room.
Mm.
You know, you can actually do that. And it kind of takes you out of your body, because you're not in your body anyway. But when you do that, the me is non-localized. You realize that the me has no location at all. You know, it's certainly not located in the body. But once you realize me is not located in the body, but this whole Maya located in it, you can say, you can't say the me, this me is like a pea in a pod in the body. It's not. So you can just practice, just focus on, you know, focus on yourself, be yourself, and then put that me in the middle of the room.
How do you put it in the middle?
Just with your mind. Just imagine it in the middle of the room.
Is the point of that's impossible?
It's not impossible. It's already in the middle of the room. It's already not. It's not like a pea in the pod, like a little round nugget of consciousness sitting there, like a in the middle of the room, like a little walnut or something. It's not like that. But it's that yourself is truly not contained by the creation. It's not contained. Okay, but you will take until you know that yourself is contained in the body, not that it's contained in the room, not that it pervades the whole room, and it pervades only from the standpoint of space, from the standpoint of you. It doesn't pervade anything.
Right.
It has no time or space. So put that me, which has no time and space, in the middle of the room instead of in your body.
Mm.
You think it's in your body. It's not in your body. The whole creation is in your being.
If you don't think it's in your body, can you still put it in the middle of the room?
If you don't think it's your body, then you don't need to put it in the middle of the room.
Okay, good.
That's just an exercise to help people who think that they're contained, that the self is contained in the body, or the self is contained in the mind. It's not contained.
Some of us were able to sort of view this physical body from a distance anyway, and it's like a really shock and a wake up call. Wow, now this body's just sitting there, and here I am sort of like floating up and looking at it.
Yeah, like especially people who are in surgery, sometimes they float up to the top of the ceiling and look down and see. That's the Sukshma Sharira up there, looking down here.
Okay.
But this is,
when you're done, I have a question.
Okay. This is not the Sukshma Sharira.
Mm-hmm.
It's just conscious being, which has no dimension. It's not big or small, it's non-dual. But you think that the non-dual self that cannot be objectified is located in your body.
Mm-hmm.
It's not located in your body. Everything is located in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so to recognize that, you can do these little, this is just one little practice.
Yeah.
To recognize, you know, that you're not located. If there's no space, there's no location. You know, so even though by putting it in the middle of the room, there's a location as though, but still you're unembodied.
Mm-hmm.
There's just you, and you're unembodied.
And that way, you're already there.
You're already everywhere. Wherever you are, you're totally there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always from the standpoint of the creation. But then you can start recognizing yourself.
Mm.
It's just a trick.
Yeah.
To help you, you know, just a little gimmicky thing to help you recognize yourself. You know, but it works. It's very interesting.
I understand that my being has no location. That concept doesn't even make sense for that. Where I get more tripped up is in that my being, myself, doesn't enjoy anything.
Oh, but that's not fair.
Uh-huh.
Except, tell me what you mean. Maybe I didn't understand.
Okay. Well, at the beginning of the Drisha Viveka, you think of a sakshi.
Yeah.
And you think, okay, I perceive, I enjoy the sight of that basket, therefore I'm not that basket. I perceive, I enjoy my sense organs, therefore I'm not my sense organs. But then somewhere towards the end, it suddenly kind of turns over and you realize actually you don't perceive or enjoy anything. and that everything enjoys you as the material cause.
Oh, you know what the problem is? And I picked this up in India from Swamiji, and I just use it all of the time, and it's not even English. It's the use of the word enjoy in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoy means not that I'm enjoying it, that I'm liking it, that I'm having a good time with it. That's not...
No, I understand that.
Oh, you do?
Uh-huh.
Then what's the problem then? I don't get it. Well, I thought you were using
maybe
enjoy.
Maybe we could use the word perceive instead.
Okay, let's do perceive.
I perceive the basket.
Yeah.
Therefore, I'm not the basket. You know, I perceive my... I can even perceive my sense organs, therefore I'm not my sense organs.
Well, now, this is a prakriya. This prakriya is one of the very, usually, there's different pathways you take to completing this vision. You have to start somewhere. And so one of the easiest places to start is the strict drisha, see or seeing differentiation, because of the strong identity you have with the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you can recognize that there is a subject-object relationship between you and your body, then the subject is then differentiated from the object.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then I can look at the object and with my buddhi, and I can turn my attention toward the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's a viveka, a differentiation there. And you move inward in the sense of the sense organs are aware of the body. You know, then you see that, yes, I know my body because of my five sense organs, and without them, the body wouldn't even exist for me. So we do a little unfoldment around that, and then we realize, well, the sense organs are an excellent tool for knowing this world, including the body, but the sense organs also are known by the mind, and so now there's a differentiation between the sense organs and the mind. Right, and I can go back and forth. This is the sense organs. These are the sense organs. I objectify them. And then I focus on the mind, and I see that there's a subject-object relationship there. You know? And in fact, there's other little things that we can say in this. Like for instance, the sense organs are just a tool of the mind. So if the mind is imagining or doing something that doesn't, you know, daydreaming. The sense organs are there waiting to be used, but they're not being used because the mind is doing something else. But so then you start to see a difference, subject-object difference between the mind and the sense organs, and then between the sense organs and the body. And then you start to see a subject-object differentiation between the sakshi and the mind, between awareness and the subject, me, and the mind, which is objectified and is continually changing, and the vrittis come and go, but you're always there. So now I have some space, some viveka, discrimination between these two. So now the subject is not the object. Right? So I can remove, just mentally, remove all of these things that have been objectified from me. And I can do that because I've done this viveka, this discrimination, which usually is not done at all. And so that what happens is that my buddhi then singles out me from all of the things that I had identified with previously, like the mind and the sense organs, the prana we can do also, you know, and the physical body. And so this allows me to recognize kind of the invariable, non-objectifiable self. I get down to that which cannot be objectified. If it can be objectified, it's maya. If it can't be objectified, the only thing that can't be objectified is self-evident consciousness. Everything else can be objectified because it exists within time and space and can be subject to this knower-known dichotomy, this knower-known dyad. You know? So this particular prakriya and this different prakriya, this is a good one because it focuses on the nature of the self that we're talking about. So that you recognize yourself, and that's only the beginning of that prakriya. It gets you to recognize your own, the conscious being, which is now differentiated from all of the upadis. And then once you get there, then the question is, how can the conscious being that I am be separate from the conscious being you are? because even space has been objectified. It all exists as Maya. So what is going to divide me from you? There's nothing. So for the body, mind, sense organs, all of these things are differentiated from the self, and they're also differentiated from each other. But how to differentiate consciousness when it's not objectifiable, and even the things within duality that would be able to differentiate or divide one from the other? Like for a space is a good divider, right? You're over here, you're here, you're over here. But you can't do that with consciousness, because even space is objectified, so there's no over here or over there. And so then you recognize that this consciousness is one consciousness, that there's only one. But now you have to recognize it's one non-dual consciousness, which means that this whole creation, you have to recognize it's mithya. So there's a lot of prakriyas that will make you recognize that this creation has no independent being. I think I'm going beyond your question.
That's fine.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Master, what is it that objectifies the buddhi?
Awareness. The buddhi is known.
The buddhi is known. Okay. But then we talk though about the self as not being a knower.
Right. The self is known. The nature of the self is known. So if you get rid of the whole creation, what is left is the self, which is known.
Okay.
And that is knownness is like a, not an attribute, but the very swarupa of the self. And so we think there's a knower, but there isn't. There's just self-evident knownness, and that illumines the buddhi, so the buddhi is known. That's superimposed on the buddhi, so knownness actually is superimposed on the buddhi. It belongs to itself.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
But you can make that differentiation, but it doesn't seem to stabilize it. You go back to thinking, I am the buddhi.
That's the jiva. That's the jiva. Because you get caught up in the creation.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the creation being Ishwara and just responding with dharma to what comes your way, there's things you have to do. You know, worries about whether you'll succeed, financial pressures, maybe I'll become a bad lady or, you know, bad man.
Yeah, or unconscious attitudes.
Unconscious attitudes, all of that. That's all sadhana after sadhana. Mm. And that all amounts to bringing back your knowledge to these kind of unconscious or what we call habitual ways of behaving that are all based in ignorance. Totally habitual. So you can't expect that. It's not really fair to you, to the situation or to your psyche to think that you gain some knowledge and then everything just, you know, shifts into place.
Seems to be like a kind of some kind of qualitative difference. So that point, you see, it's all very logical where the buddhi can objectify everything. But then for the buddhi to be objectified,
the buddhi,
there's some kind of... That seems like a bit of... There's a leap there of some kind, right?
Well,
that's quite radical when that happens.
In a sense, this is the leap for the Ajnani when you're gaining knowledge. The leap is that you have something to attribute knowership with when you're within duality, even though the experience is only known.
Right.
There is no experience of knowing a knower.
Right.
It's only known.
Yeah.
But you're still within the realm of where, you know, your mind is thinking, your eyes are seeing that. So that knowership that creates an identity for you is that you have something to land on.
Yeah.
You see?
Right.
But when you go beyond every upadhi and you still realize these all upadhis are known,
right.
then the knower, who is the knower? Who is the knower? Because, but it's known.
Yeah, there is no knower, but there is knownness or
there
knowing.
There is knownness.
Or,
there's the nature of the self, which is known, and which is me.
And which has always been there.
Always been there, always will be, is free of time. And that the self-evident knownness is what illumines the buddhi.
But there seems to be some, it's like a breakthrough when you can...
It's a big breakthrough because you didn't even know about that self-evident knownness at all. It's a huge thing.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you realize that yourself is independent of these things that you thought were it.
So when I'm sitting here and I have this self-evident knownness, how do I experience that, or what's the sensation for that?
The sensation is me. I am known. Nothing is lighting you up. You're kind of the, you know, what do you call it?
A glow?
The bottom line or something.
It's the buck stops.
Yeah, that's it. The buck stops here. Right at my Atman.
Is that known is how you talk?
What? What?
I think you said, I am known.
Yes. Not because the I am known by my, because of my own nature. My own nature is consciousness.
Self-evident.
The knownness is
expressed, I am known.
It doesn't say that.
It's just like amness is or known.
Yeah, amness is, knownness is. There's nobody saying I am known.
Okay.
It just is. Mm-hmm. And because the self is self-evident, that self-evident consciousness, you know, butts up against the mitya maya, the maya. And so the knownness of consciousness, self-evident nature of consciousness, and the vritti are superimposed on each other. Because sattva, reflects of the sattva vritti, can say, you know, I am the conscious being. Then the vritti realizes through this prakriya that I myself am known. So then the consciousness, and then we fabricate this word, the sakshi. I am the sakshi. Consciousness is called the sakshi, the witness from the standpoint of the buddhi, which is known. But then to complete this prakriya, you have to remove from the sakshi all of the things that can be that are being known, because those are objectified. They don't belong to you. So you get rid of all of those, and then you're just the sakshi of what? You're not the sakshi of anything, because nothing's there. Right? And nor is there any instrument. So there is no knowership, and there never is at all anyway. If you analyze your experience from like, if I say from the wall all the way through, the wall is known, the space is known, you are all known, the body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, the self is known, space is known, the ahankara is known, my knowledges and ignorances, all of them are known. All the way to the self is known, means self-evident. So then you try to find the knower, and all you find is known. It is known, it is known, it is known. Then that is the swarup of the nature of Atma.
So you can say, I am knownness. I mean, that's what it seems to be.
People don't tend to like it, but I've really had trouble, and I've never given up on it, even though nobody really appreciates this. On the knownness. Yeah.
I like the knownness.
Yeah, people are starting.
We like it.
Yeah. Some people are starting to appreciate it.
Coming around.
It's been years and years. It's using this is knownness. But to me, it's so important. But it's hard to communicate it. To make it clear.
Did you say that somebody is like the spokesperson for that moment and then has to just disown all the superimpositions, just one after another? Is that like a maintenance job?
No. When you have knowledge, then that problem, superimposition, doesn't take place. The buddhi is the buddhi, the world is the world, the atma is the atma. They're not confused.
The atma is still experienced, self-evident?
The aham, that real, not the word aham, but the self, is self-evident, always. And that's another milestone in gaining this knowledge, is realizing no matter what is going on in your mind, what emotions are there, the self is still, the self is exactly the same. It's not affected. Of course, the emotions can be very, very positive or very, very dark or very hurtful, painful emotions. So we don't. It's not that we want to have those emotions. Well, that's not the point. The point is that yourself is not covered or changed by those emotions. And that's a hard one, because people want to have a vritti, which is the self. So you have these emotions, so Swamiji, I know myself, but I'm always, you know, when will all these dark emotions go so that I can experience myself? Mm-hmm. That's a problem, because yourself is never not experienced. It's self-evident, and it's not, and you're not, not and that's just Maya. I mean, if you there's no moksha in that, because you're just waiting for shanta vrittis and trying to ward off negative vrittis. You know,
yeah.
The shanta vritti is me. You know,
mm-hmm.
Now I have a shanta vritti. This is it's just totally samsara.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So you're, so the thing is, recognizing your own nature is inviolate. You know, it's invariable, it's totally inviolate. And then, and it is the ananda really that you seek, that you're projecting on the world and running after. Mm-hmm. And as the mind understands that, it just loves to stay home with the self, rooted in the self, and then experience the world as Ishwara. And you let Ishwara's, let the power of the karma basically take care of you. Not that you become like a lazy bum or something, it's not that. But you're responding to Ishwara all the time. What is the dharma in this situation? That's what you're called to do. It's just like a worship, a bhagavan. Always, you're always in relationship to Ishwara from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. That's karma yoga. And that's really helps to settle down the mind, to kind of work through the habitual ignorance. You're just habitual behavior, because from countless lifetimes.
I'm not sure how to ask this question. When I go into Shavasana,
yeah,
and if it's a deep one, I feel like my consciousness is there, but suddenly all the edges of the vrittis are clear. They're still there, but they're not in the center ring.
Yeah. I think that as with Shavasana and other postures, but especially for that one, the body becomes so relaxed,
yes,
that you can't feel its edges. First of all, just from the body. Like Swamiji says in the meditative posture, he says you should be like this. This is how he teaches it. So you have just your regular meditative, but then your hands should be like this. Sarah does. And he says the hands should become so relaxed that you can't really feel them. And so in the deep relax, like with Shavasana, in the very deep relaxation of the body, you lose all of the edges of the body. When you lose the edges of the body, then the mind is not feeling at all contained even by the body, you know. And so that's actually very wonderful. But it just means that the body is so relaxed that it almost disappears, actually. Mm. Just because the level of deep relaxation, it's not calling any attention to itself. It's like the body relaxes into space and just becomes one of the part of space in a way.
Yeah, I always come out of it totally refreshed.
Yes, it's a deep, deep sleep. Not sleep, though, that's not that you're sleeping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's very, very, very restful. And to hold that for a time, I think, I feel it must be very, very healthy for the body. And what the association there is that in Ayurveda, if you have some sort of something wrong, and you go to the Ayurvedic hospital, the main thing they want, the main treatment, is rest. They want complete rest. They don't want you reading books. They don't want you on the computer. You know, they don't want you to be walking around very much. Rest for a long period of time, like 4 or 5 weeks. And it could be much longer than that. But rest itself is such a great, great healer. Mm-hmm. We don't even know what that is. I have been at the Ayurveda. I went with with actually Kristen and I went a few times, and it was just amazing. You know, besides the body massage, total massage, every day for about an hour of massaging, you know, medicinal oils into your body, but also just that touch, you know, and then complete rest, complete rest, complete rest. It's so healing. The body gives the body the optimal chance to heal itself. You put it in the optimal situation to heal itself. So I was thinking that Shavasana is like a little bitty, little momentary, deep, deep rest.
What was that Sanskrit word you're using?
Shavasana.
Huh?
Shavasana.
Corpse pose.
The corpse pose, where you lie down just flat and just let your body totally. I'm sure there's more to the posture than that, but that's basically it.
Well, I can do that one.
we'll get you going on that. That'll take care of a lot of problems. I just said, do the Shavasana.
After yoga.
Can that be taken further?
Tell me more. Can what be taken care of?
The Shavasana, once you're in such a deep state of rest.
I think it can, because it so much frees up.
Yes.
Your mind, because when the body is resting like that, you kind of, the mind also experiences, the buddhi also experiences that deep rest, and then it can be very good for contemplation, except that you're lying down. One of the things is to don't lie down when you're contemplating, because that's the position for sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But it doesn't have to be, you know. Tell me what you're thinking or what you've experienced in terms of taking it further in terms of knowing yourself.
Well, the breath becomes so subtle that it becomes like a thread. So I feel the thread from the heart all the way to the top of the head, and then I feel like I'm not there anymore.
Yeah. What do you mean by not there anymore?
Well, I'm not in my physical body, that I've expanded into the whole room.
That's right. Yeah, that's the feeling.
Oh.
And the breath becomes so, so slight.
Mm. Yeah, but the breath is, that's all that's left.
Yeah.
And
yes,
so
yeah.
It's just.
I haven't done that for a while, but I know, I can imagine what you're talking about.
So, it just started to happen, so I wanted to ask you what that was about.
Well, you know, the whole Ashtanga Yoga, the Yama Niyama, the asana, all of the things that go with Pratyahara and all those, they're designed, Pranayama Pratyahara, they are designed for samadhi. All of the asanas are. That's the end goal, to be able to, for the body to hold that position for an hour of deep, deep relaxation, so the mind is free to just absorb into the self, and the limitations of the body are not noticed. You know? I don't know what else to say about it, but it sounds like when you do the Shavasana, that's working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but my awareness is still there. I'm not asleep at all.
No, but awareness, yeah.
So
awareness is always there.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is your mind is still awake.
Yes.
Yeah, and so it's just not going into kind of a causal condition of pure ignorance, we call that. So if your mind still is awake, it will be some sort of a samadhi experience.
You mentioned the other satsang.
Jada Samadhi.
Yeah.
Jada Samadhi means, say, you're doing it, you have no self-knowledge. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But you're doing the exercise, which is the Shavasana, and you're doing it very deeply. You will have an experience, even a very expansive experience, or just an experience of your being without any identification with the body. But then when you come back from that experience, you don't have a knowledge base to know what that's all about, even though it's very beautiful and it's very real and all of that, that's not questioned. But you don't know what it is in reference to your own being. There's still ajnana there. So jada means the ignorance, the self-ignorance is still there.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anything?
I feel, I really liked verse 26 this morning, the ending of the Panchadasana. I kind of feel that's where I am. Because as long as I talk about my being, these things make sense to me. Oh, yeah, of course my being isn't located in any particular place or a particular time. Of course, that's obvious. But when I try to say I,
yeah,
I think I'm still not comfortable. I want to identify myself with the Buddha on some level. And even though I can see that's a little strange, how could I be different from my being?
Well, the thing is, the buddhi, just like a good old clay pot, just like the pot is the clay, the buddhi is the self.
Mm-hmm.
There's no distance there at all. There's no distance at all between nitya and satyam. There can't be, because the nitya has no being. The being is the satyam, so there's no room for any kind of distance. But the thing is that that self is independent of the buddhi. The buddhi being mithya, like when the body dies and the buddhi goes into unmanifest condition or whatever, yourself doesn't die. Yourself doesn't change. The buddhi is continually replacing itself, one vritti after another, but yourself is exactly the same. You know, same presence. Not the slightest shift,
mm-hmm,
as all of those modifications take place in the mind. And so you start to realize that your being, the being which is the very self of the buddhi, is free of the buddhi. It's the self, the self is the self of the buddhi, the self of the world, and free of the world. Even Ishwara, the self is the self of Ishwara, and free of Ishwara. Because Ishwara is the Maya Upadhi.
Can I clarify?
Yeah.
This with the imagination and the dream example, there it's easier to see that, yeah, the mind is the object, and in this reality, you know, the mind takes it to be both the subject and the object from different standpoints.
Tell me again, I missed some point there.
In the dream example or,
yeah,
imagination,
yeah,
it's quite clear that the mind is the object.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's not so hard to see.
Yeah.
But in this reality, there seems to be the mind wants to take it both as the object and as the subject. But from the sakshi, it's the object.
Mm-hmm.
But from the point of the mind, it takes itself to be the subject.
Yes. Because there's ajnanam there.
Yeah.
Ajnanam is also mithya. There's ajnanam, and because of that, there's the ahankara. So even if you realize the mind is objectified, that yes, you're aware of your thoughts, but that doesn't make you think you're not your mind. Even though you know you're aware of your thoughts, they come and go. But that's me. That's how it is. That's you know, that viveka isn't there. That viveka has to be kind of taught. You have to be taken step by step by step. Otherwise, even though you're aware of your mind, you still think you're your mind. Even though the thoughts come and go, you still think you're the thoughts.
But
even
by understanding the mithya more.
Yeah, oh yeah. Then that starts changing it a lot, because there's a viveka,
mm-hmm,
between yourself, the discrimination between the stability, changelessness of your being, and all of these things that come and go. Like, how can you can say, I'm sad, but what you should mean that, you know, I'm having, my mind is sad, my mind is sad, or I'm having a sad vritti, or I'm experiencing some sadness. Not that I want you to start talking like that, but I'm experiencing some sadness right now. I don't think so. You know, but the thing is, the sadness, you know, is replaced by something neutral, or happiness is replaced by neutral or sadness. All these different emotions, they come and go. I remain. So it really doesn't make sense that I take myself to be the things that go when I remain. And it's so obvious when you point it out. But until it's pointed out, we just say, oh, that's just how it is, kind of. You don't even think about it, you know. But logically, it's impossible. Should we go to bed? What time is it? It's late. Okay. Om Swasti Prajapati Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahimahishaha Ko Brahmanirya Shivamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Varahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhagavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityurmahamritamgamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadashyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om